Traditional revenue sources for public media and media at large are declining this year, and we at Marketplace are not immune to those trends. We're currently tracking behind target for this budget year. We're tightening up our expenses, yes, but the need for trusted, grounded, fact-based reporting is as pressing as ever, and we simply cannot cut back on our mission. So we're turning to the listeners like you. Please step up now and invest in Marketplace. If you haven't given yet, now's the time. Go to marketplace.org/donate. Hey, if you're listening to this, I will assume you're at least interested in money, understanding the economy, and finances as well. And some of us now want to get the next generation interested as well. So check out Million Bazillion, Marketplace's award-winning kids podcast that breaks down money to help dollars make more sense. Tune into Million Bazillion wherever you find your favorite podcasts. A whole new season is out now. Million Bazillion is presented in partnership with Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Greenlight helps kids and teens learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. Get 1 month free and an extra $10 when you sign up for a Greenlight account at greenlight.com/million. When was the last time you changed your mind? Economically, I mean. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Monday today, the 23rd day of October. Good as always to have you along, everybody. We are in month two of what I think one can say without too terribly much fear of contradiction is the most important antitrust trial of the 21st century. Granted, we are not even a quarter of the way through said century, but United States v. Google LLC is a biggie. A keyword search of the government's original complaint tells you exactly what this case is all about. Default is the keyword in question. The Department of Justice says Google paid Apple and others billions of dollars a year to be the default search engine on devices of all kinds. Google says it's just better. And anyway, if consumers really wanted to use some other search engine, nothing's stopping them. But come on, how often do you really change the defaults on anything? Marketplace's Matt Levin starts us off today on the consumer inertia beat.
Jared Spool has been trying to design more user-friendly tech since the late 1970s. If you're still using a full-size keyboard, you may be familiar with one of his claims to fame.
I was on the team that invented those six buttons that are above the arrow keys.
Insert, home, page up, delete, end, page down?
Yeah, you got it.
That's you, Jared?
Yeah.
Spool now runs a tech design consulting firm called Center Center, all focused on the user experience. He says in his nearly half century in the business, defaults have always been incredibly powerful, even when they don't make sense. He remembers when autosave in Microsoft Word was turned off by default.
People would memorize the shortcut for saving.
That's Control S.
And they would develop that as just a knee-jerk reaction. Do a little bit of work.
Hit Control S.
Do a little bit of work.
Hit Control S again.
Do a little bit of work.
You get the picture. Behavioral economists have been talking about the power of defaults for decades. You know, if a company auto-enrolls you in a 401k, you're more likely to save for retirement, that type of thing. But Spool says with default settings in hardware or software, there's often more fear at play.
Because there was some time in the past where you changed a setting and then everything broke and you couldn't connect why it wasn't working to the fact that you'd changed the setting. And so it's scary to change those settings.
And even if you are willing to risk an hour of hold time on the tech support hotline and want to change those defaults, well, if they make the tech companies money, they're not going to make it very intuitive to change them.
It's sort of like going into someone's house and they tell you to help yourself to a glass of water, and you open up the cabinet that seems logical to you, but there aren't any glasses in that. So you have to open up the next one. You have to open up the next one.
Google pays billions of dollars annually for default status, partly because that consumer inertia makes their search engine better at returning the right results. Katie Van Dyke is senior counsel at the American Economic Liberties Project, an anti-monopoly advocacy group.
They have created a feedback loop where they get more users and more ads and more data and better search, and it has locked every competitor out.
It's not just Van Dyke saying this. In a twist of antitrust irony, Microsoft CEO Satya Nadella essentially testified that Google is better at search than Microsoft Bing because of all the data it gets from being a default. Microsoft lost its antitrust case in the early 2000s over web browser defaults, which arguably paved the way for Google. And while the U.S. has been slow to interrupt the default search feedback loop, Europe has tried to regulate it.
Google essentially lost this default issue in Europe. So when you get your new phone or you get your new laptop and you take it out of the box and turn it on for the first time, you are given a menu of search engines.
The EU applied that solution to Android phones, which Google owns. So far, the results are somewhat mixed, says Steve Tedelis at UC Berkeley's Haas School of Business.
It turns out that most people still choose Google because we know that Google is the superior search engine at the moment.
Many people just don't know non-Google search engines by name. So in an internet of an exhaustingly infinite number of choices, they default to the brand they know. I'm Matt Levin for Marketplace.
Ticker symbol GOOG today, tracking, of course, not Google, but its parent company, Alphabet, up a bit more than 1% today. The broader markets, well, tech was up a bit. Most everything else went the other way a bit. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Hey, what were you doing 16 years ago? I ask because 16 years ago, June of 2007, if you're looking for specifics, that was the last time the yield on the benchmark 10-year Treasury note hit 5%. Now, on the face of it, yields are going up because the Fed's been raising rates fast and furious the past year and a half. But the past 2 weeks, yields have been spiking without obvious cause, dragging all kinds of other interest rates with them. Mortgages, for starters, we talked about that, up around 8% right now. So we sent Marketplace's Sabri Benishore off today to find the answer to this question. Why is this happening now?
10-year treasuries have to look good for 10 years. They have to look good compared to the interest rates of today and compared to the interest rates of the future. Right now, yields on the 10-year are high, in part because people believe the interest rates of the future will also be high. This is what the Fed has been signaling for months.
People are taking the Fed seriously.
Scott DiMaggio is co-head of fixed income at Alliance Bernstein. For a while, bond markets did not believe the Fed would keep future interest rates high.
We go back 4, 5, 6 months ago, the market was working with a narrative of a recession and significantly slower economic growth. They were forecasting at some points that the Fed would have to reduce rates next year by 5 or 6 times.
So why did bond investors suddenly start believing that the interest rates of the future would not fall, but instead would stay high?
The economy is proving to be more resilient.
Steve Lipley is global head of bond ETFs for BlackRock. Strong jobs numbers and other data kept trickling in, suggesting maybe we will not have a recession next year, and so maybe the Fed won't have to cut rates.
There's also a growing concern around the deficit.
The deficit is growing, which means the government is issuing more and more debt. Somebody's got to buy it. Somebody's got to get convinced to buy it. You know what's really convincing? Making more money, higher yields. Another reason the 10-year yields of today are so insanely high.
You know, actually, historically speaking, they're not that high.
David Krauss is emeritus professor of finance at Marquette University. He points out that on average, over 100 years, long-term treasury yields were 5.2%, close to where they are now.
So I think what seems high is that we haven't had these rates for maybe 20 years. They were artificially depressed by the Federal Reserve.
Between the great financial crisis and a pandemic, it has kind of been one emergency after another that has had the Fed trying to keep short-term interest rates in the economy low in general, which is filtered into 10-year treasuries too, Krauss says. But that era might just be over. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
All right, let's talk budget deficits here. I'm talking specifically about the U.S. federal budget deficit, of course, which we learned last week was $1.7 trillion for the just-ended 2023 fiscal year. effectively doubling in a year thanks to some weird budgetary accounting. The thing is about budget deficits that there is a spending side to them. We spend more than we take in, right? Talk about that a lot. But there is a revenue side as well, about which, well, a lot less is said. Here's Marketplace's Kimberly Adams to balance out that equation.
The vast majority of federal revenue comes from taxes, and the 9% drop in revenues in fiscal year 2023 was mostly due to a drop in individual income taxes, including capital gains.
And of course, the 2017 tax cut was a real tax cut and has reduced revenues.
Bill Gale is a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, and I asked him why, when people are talking about deficits, we often hear a lot more about spending compared to revenues.
Tax cuts are usually discussed independently from spending or the deficit, but the conversations really need to be integrated.
Because he says any spending implies the need for future taxes. For now, the IRS is focusing on just making sure it actually gets all the taxes owed, especially from wealthier people.
Every dollar spent auditing these high-income tax individuals would collect more than $12 in additional tax revenue.
Amy Matsui is the director of income security at the National Women's Law Center. The IRS has started cracking down on high net worth tax evaders, and the agency said Friday it's already collected $122 million from about 100 cases.
You know, this is more than shaking change out of the couch cushions, but looking at the taxes that are already due and giving the IRS the resources to go after them could take a chunk out of the deficit.
But, says Garrett Watson, a senior policy analyst at the Tax Foundation.
Even if you're a fan of changing the way in which we tax the rich, that becomes mathematically very hard to sustain when you're looking at just the magnitude of the deficit change that we're looking at over the next, 30 plus years.
Closing that gap, he says, will probably require a mix of reduced spending and higher taxes from a broader swath of the economy. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
During the writer's strike this summer, where, among other things, better wages were high on the list, Disney CEO Bob Iger called the union's expectations just not realistic. That's a quote. And it landed in Hollywood among the writers, well, with kind of a thud, considering that Iger makes something like 500 times more than the median salary of his own employees. Kristen Toussaint is an editor at Fast Company, and her team just put out a special report analyzing CEO pay these days. Welcome to the program.
Thanks so much for having me.
Why now is CEO pay a big thing, do you think? I mean, it seems like it's been since the financial crisis, really, that CEO pay has been in the spotlight like this.
Definitely. The financial crisis was a huge point for realizing the incentives that go into CEO pay that can really drive it to extremes. But we've seen it coming up in union fights lately. UAW President Sean Fain brought up the fact that it would take a typical battery plant worker 16 years to make what GM's CEO makes in 1 week. And it's come up in shareholder votes, like Netflix shareholders recently denied pay packages to their executive after this topic came up so much with the writer's strike.
You know, for a long time, it was just kind of accepted that the people who were the CEOs running these big companies got the big money. Now it has become unfashionable, to say the least. Where does the idea come from, or where did the idea come from, that CEOs ought to be paid all this money?
Well, it's interesting to look at how much this has actually changed. You know, back in 1965, the CEO to typical worker pay ratio was just 20 to 1. And in 1989, it was 58 to 1. And some reports now put it around 325 to 1. But we're also seeing ratios that far exceed that. You know, in one of the most extreme examples we pointed out at Fast Company, Live Nation's ratio is 5,414 to 1. And then I think now people are really starting to question that. You know, you would think that more risk and more work from a CEO position deserves a higher pay, but is it, you know, 1,000 times the risk right, and 1,000 times the work? Especially during the pandemic, you know, we saw that frontline, often low-wage workers were just so crucial to keeping the economy going. And so you have to wonder, you know, is a CEO's value really hundreds or 1,000 times those workers as well?
So if the consensus or the emerging consensus among a part of this society is that CEOs are making disproportionate amounts of money, whether it's 300 times what the average worker makes or 5,000 times what the average worker makes, is there a way to more judiciously measure what a CEO ought to be paid?
Yeah, there's a few efforts to sort of both get a grasp on CEO pay and rein it in. You know, I mean, the SEC disclosure on pay ratios, which was a rule that came out in 2017, is a big part of us understanding just how much these CEOs are making. And that's because their pay is so complicated. You know, it's not just a straight salary. It's also often stock options and incentive bonuses. And then there's, you know, a bunch of people working on figuring out what a CEO should actually be getting paid. I mean, Portland and San Francisco recently put a tax on businesses with a ratio above 100 to 1. Hmm. And then there's a couple of groups like the Institute of Policy Studies says that the ideal ratio is closer to 20 to 1.
Do you expect actual change on this? I mean, look, you guys have devoted a lot of time and energy to bringing this issue to the forefront. What do you think?
Yeah, I think the fact that it has become a topic that unions are bringing up and that is gaining this attention is a hopeful sign. I mean, companies are paying attention to this. They're paying attention to the optics of it and the impacts of it. I mean, really high CEO to worker pay ratios are also associated, you know, with a host of negative business practices, with less productivity, higher turnover. So I think as those things come to light more, we'll maybe see not only some CEOs take it upon themselves to say, you know, how can I change this for the betterment of my employees and my work, but also maybe some bigger policy changes.
Yeah. Kristen Toussaint, she's an editor at Fast Company. Kristen, thanks a lot. I appreciate your time and your expertise.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Coming up, to quit or not to quit.
But then I stopped myself. I'm like, you know, the other job is pretty easy.
First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial is down 190 today, about 0.6%, 32,936. The NASDAQ gained 34 points, nearly 0.3% there. Closed at 13,018. The S&P 500 gave back 7 points, almost 0.2%, 42.17 on the day there. We heard from Matt Levin about how tech companies will get you to make their search engine your default browser, which can shape your buying behavior. Also, when was the last time, honestly, you changed the default? Looking at you, Alphabet, Google's parent company, up 0.6%, as I said. Microsoft, which owns Bing, grew 0.8%. Chevron has agreed to buy Hess Corporation in a $53 billion with a B dollar deal, which will give Chevron a bigger stake in U.S. oil production. Chevron dipped almost 0.3% today. Hess lost about 1%. Bonds up, yield on the 10-year T-note down, relatively speaking, 4.84%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Looking for the highest interest rate on your cash? At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty darn up there. This is paid for by Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Traditional revenue sources for public media and media at large are declining this year, and we at Marketplace are not immune to those trends. We're currently tracking behind target for this budget year. We're tightening up our expenses, yes, but the need for trusted, grounded, fact-based reporting is as pressing as ever, and we simply cannot cut back on our mission. So we're turning to the listeners like you. Please step up now and invest in Marketplace. If you haven't given yet, now's the time. Go to marketplace.org/donate.
My name is Lee Hawkins. I've been a journalist for over 25 years. On my new podcast, What Happened in Alabama, I get answers to some of the hardest questions about how things came to be for many Black Americans and the truth that must come before any reconciliation can happen. I investigate my family history, my upbringing in Minnesota, and my father's painful nightmares about growing up in Alabama. What Happened in Alabama is a new series confronting the cycles of trauma for myself, my family, and for many Black Americans. Listen now.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. The high-profile organized labor news of this day is that the United Auto Workers has expanded its strike against Detroit's Big Three. Stellantis is the target today. It's plant in Sterling Heights, Michigan, that makes the oh-so-profitable Dodge Ram truck series. Over the weekend, though, to substantially less fanfare, some 360 workers at the St. Lawrence Seaway walked off the job. The Seaway is a system of canals and channels and locks that connects the Great Lakes to the Atlantic, which lets cargo ships get in and out of the middle of North America. Last year, to the tune of almost $13 billion worth of cargo. Marketplace's Savannah Marr is on the waterborne transport desk today.
The Seaway was built by the U.S. and Canadian governments in the 1950s to connect the upper Midwestern states and prairie provinces to global markets.
Yeah, the St. Lawrence Seaway is a main artery.
Michael Folsom is with the Seaway Shipwatchers Network, and he says it can't function without those striking workers who are looking for wage increases.
It's almost, you know, a chokehold from Montreal to Lake Erie.
In Canada, the biggest worry is how farm economies will fare during the strike, says Sylvain Charlebois, a professor of agribusiness at Dalhousie University in Halifax.
Our estimate is that there's about $6 to $7 billion worth of grains that are exported from the St. Lawrence Seaway.
Every year, mostly to Europe and the Middle East. Charlebois says the disruption comes just as Canadian wheat farmers are looking to ship their harvests.
We're in the middle of October here. We need to move product.
And while the war in Ukraine and extreme weather around the world are also squeezing the global grain supply, Charlebois says the Seaway's closure could drive up commodity prices.
And that impacts the entire world.
The strike is also a headache for manufacturing in the middle of the continent, says Stephen Fisher with the American Great Lakes Ports Association.
The U.S. and Canadian auto industries are largely domiciled there. The majority of U.S. steel production happens in the Great Lakes region.
And relies on iron ore imported via the St. Lawrence Seaway. Fisher says if the strike goes on much longer, all the goods that typically come in and out of the region by ship will have to be put on wheels, a costlier and less climate-friendly option. I'm Savannah Marr for Marketplace.
Those of us lucky enough to work remotely know well the benefits. Less time spent commuting, flexibility, shall we say, in scheduling, and yes, always the possibility of an increase in productivity. But some people are secretly taking those perks to the extreme, working more than one remote job at a time. Moonlighting, once upon a time, is what it was called. Today, it's called overemployment, and we don't really know how many people are doing it because between contract work and jobs that pay under the table, it's a tough phenomenon for the Labor Department to track. But there is a growing community of these workers talking online who say since the pandemic, working multiple jobs has gotten easier. Marketplace's Kristen Schwab talked to some of them about why they do it and how they pull it off.
Growing up, Molly was taught the classic idea of work ethic.
Get a job, work in the cubicle or wherever they assign you, work 120% and move up the corporate ladder.
Molly lives with her husband near Los Angeles and has four kids. She makes videos for employee onboarding, cybersecurity training, that kind of thing. And she says for most of her career, she subscribed to that idea of being loyal to your employer. That changed when she was laid off during the pandemic. She got a part-time job, and when she later landed a similar full-time job, her initial plan was to resign from job number one.
But then I stopped myself. I'm like, you know, the other job is pretty easy.
It was November 2020, and Molly decided, even though the hours overlapped, she could do both jobs for a while.
Why don't I just try to keep doing this and just have a better Christmas and surprise the kids and enjoy ourselves a little bit, and then after the New Year's, I'll quit.
Except she didn't quit. Molly is still working two jobs. I should say Molly is a pseudonym. And she's taking this risk because for the first time, she's making six figures. But it doesn't come easy. Molly has to be a sort of multitasking octopus. Each job has its own laptop, labeled with a bright post-it note. And when two Zoom meetings overlap, she turns the audio on and camera off for job number one, and audio off and camera on for job number two.
I'm following the cues of everybody else. If they're laughing and clapping, I'm doing the same. It's like being an actress.
There are online forums full of people sharing similar tips for how to make this work. Job two wants a meeting at the same time as job one. They say there's a family emergency. One company wants to put the person's photo on its staff webpage. They might say they can't. They have a stalker. Maybe you're giving these people some heavy side eye right now. Molly's aware, but she says she's protecting herself.
I don't trust companies any longer. Are they going to give me a promotion? Are they going to give me a raise? No, I found a way to give myself a raise.
Molly says she's taken charge of her own financial security. That's a big reason why people take on multiple jobs, says Brianna Kaza, a professor of management at the University of North Carolina, Greensboro.
And it allows people to have more control over what they're doing, when they're doing it, how they're doing it.
Still, Kaza thinks overemployment is about more than money. It also reflects a skepticism of capitalism and how much workers feel they owe their employers.
And I definitely see that as being very similar to this idea of quiet quitting.
Overemployment can be an attitude, a mentality, a lifestyle. Take Aaron, again, not his real name. He's a technical writer on the West Coast who's been overemployed on and off for the last 3 years.
It's like a game. They think you are the pawn, but you're making more money than your boss, and you feel like a gangster.
Aaron doesn't exactly advertise this to his friends, but the way he sees it, both companies profited from his work. So if people who are overemployed can complete everything they're asked to,
we can do what is in our right to make more money.
Working multiple jobs is legal, though contracts often have non-compete clauses, and going against them could be grounds for termination. That's not how the end of Aaron's overemployment story goes. He's only working one job now, after getting an offer he couldn't turn down.
It's only one job, but it's equivalent to three jobs. The only time I have is to shower, eat, and sleep. There's no other time.
He says he might go back to working two less demanding jobs someday. Life was actually easier when he was overemployed. I'm Kristen Schwab for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, about which one can only say what could possibly go wrong. There's a new feature on Tinder, it seems, the dating app that'll let a user's friends and family suggest possible matches within the app. Yes, I know friends and family have been trying to set singles up for generations. This just seems perilous. Okay, we're going super quick. Here's your moment of economic context. On a day that the second big oil deal in as many weeks affirms that fossil fuels are going to be it for a long, long time. Crude oil today, down just under 2%, a touch more than $90 a barrel for Brent North Sea. Our daily production team includes Andy Corbin, Richard Cunningham, Maria Hollenhorst, Sarah Leeson, Sean McHenry, and Sophia Terenzio. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
My name is Lee Hawkins. I've been a journalist for over 25 years. On my new podcast, What Happened in Alabama, I get answers to some of the hardest questions about how things came to be for many Black Americans and the truth that must come before any reconciliation can happen. I investigate my family history, my upbringing in Minnesota, and my father's painful nightmares about growing up in Alabama. What Happened in Alabama is a new series confronting the cycles of trauma for myself
my family, and for many Black Americans. Listen now.